The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Cracking Down on Post-Transplant CMV, Guidance on Sequential Treatment with Newer Antiviral Agents. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/WAV860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started our program today. We have lots to cover, and also we love your participation through the app. I'm going to go over some logistics and housekeeping stuff first. I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Roy Shemali. I'm a professor of medicine at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and I'm co-chairing today's symposium with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Zenia Papanicolaou, who is also professor of medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. So the goals for today's is to augment your understanding of evidence supporting the integration of newer antiviral agents that we have into the treatment of resistant refractory CMV infection, but also to have some personalized treatment plan that include this newer antiviral therapy in this kind of conditions, and some guidance on the practical aspect of delivering modern antiviral therapy in this kind of very difficult and challenging cases of resistant and refractory CMV infection. So I'm going to start with the first talk, and the half of the other talk will be done by Dr. Papanicolaou. I'm going to go over the resistant refractory CMV infection definitions, risk factors, as well as some management principles. CMV is my favorite virus, but make no mistake, CMV is not my friend. Do you know who said this quote? Anyone? No? It was me, actually. And I so I said it in one of the meetings around 2 years ago, and I decided, you know, I'm going to incorporate this every time. And the reason is that when I give talk about CMV, because really, CMV, it is a fascinating virus. Still till now, we don't understand most of what it does. But it is really our enemy. It's not our friend. Because we see the impact of CMV on our patient population, especially allotransplant and maybe CAR-T patient or other cellular therapy patients. So a little bit of background about CMV. We know that our patient or our hematopoietic stem cell transplant recipient are at increased risk of CMV infection, especially allotransplant, not only infection or disease, but also mortality. The CMV serostatus of the recipients is a strong predictor of infection and disease. This is the main risk factors. The first risk factor that we look for if the recipient is seropositive for CMV before transplant. And the incidence of CMV infection is quite high. It could be up to 65% in specific type of transplant or source of transplant, like cord blood transplant, haploidentical. But this has changed over the past few years, where if you are using a primary prophylaxis with letermovir, the incidence of clinically significant CMV infection went down. It's probably around 20% based on the clinical trials, but also on real-world evidence. It's still happening. It's still common, but not as high as we used to see it before the era of prophylaxis. And we know, we learned quite a bit from many cohort studies and trials as well, that CMV viremia is associated with an increased risk of mortality within a year after transplantation, after allotransplant. And this is very interesting concept. For the past few years, we've been looking at, so having CMV viremia by itself and not CMV disease, patient could be at survival disadvantage, specifically not only viremia, but also being seropositive for CMV, put them at disadvantage for survival and all-cause mortality or non-relapse mortality. We're not talking about invasive CMV infection or end organ disease, but all-cause mortality as well. What are the major advancements over the past at least 3 decades, I would say? I'm going to touch up only on few important ones that are relevant to us clinically or at the bedside. Talking about diagnostic tools, you know, I remember when I started working in Houston at MD Anderson around 21 years ago, we used to do CMV antigenemia. We know CMV antigenemia was not really the best diagnostic test that we had, especially in someone neutropenic, it's not sensitive, number of cells, it can go up and down. So, but we moved away from it, and now it's all, most of us, if not all of us, we're doing molecular assays, looking at CMV viral loads, and hopefully it's adjusted or standardized to international unit per ml. So this is a major advance, I would say, although it is an oversensitive test. Now we're picking up even 32 IU per ml or sometime less than that. What does it mean? Or even 100 IU per ml, what does it mean? Something we're trying to learn more, and probably we are over-treating some of our patients based on this specific test or assays that we have. But at least it changed the way we approach CMV and doing surveillance. It is very helpful. Now, the other tool that we are trying to position in the future in clinical management of our patient is looking at CMV cellular-mediated immunity, the different tests. There is probably one commercially available test, but other under research, looking at interferon gamma release assay for looking for CMV-specific immunity. And this could help us in specific situations. I'm not going to talk about it much except now on this slide, where maybe it can help us in conditions where you have low-level viremia. Do I need to treat this patient, or they have enough CMV-specific T cells that can control further reactivation? What about letermovir duration for prophylaxis? Based on this assay, would it help us to either shorten or extend the use of letermovir because of lack of T cell response to CMV? Other major advancement in this field is the FDA approval of two drugs. The first one was letermovir for primary prophylaxis of adult after allo transplant, was recipient seropositive. And this has actually changed the landscape of CMV since the time we start using letermovir for prophylaxis, where the incidence of infection went down and also had impact on all-cause mortality or non-relapse mortality. And the recent also approval of maribavir for the treatment of resistant and refractory CMV infection for not only adult but age 12 and above in this patient in this specific condition, and not only stem cell transplant but also patient after solid organ transplantation, also change the outlook of this kind of infection. And we're going to go over the data in the next talk. So we'll talk a little bit about the phase 3 trial and others as well. So I think all these advances help us really to mitigate the risk of CMV in our patient population in a way where now we're seeing better outcome and less of mortality or less of difficult to manage cases as well. So let's talk a little bit about definitions on the left side of resistant or refractory CMV infection. And this is very important. We work on that, on these definitions around a few years ago. The reason is because we want to make sure we're talking the same language or we're reporting the same outcomes with the same definition when we talk about what do we mean by refractory? What do you mean by resistant infection? This way, if you want to compare the data, at least we'll have standardized definitions. And what we decided on based on many meetings with experts from all over the world, actually part of the CMV forum, that we're going to define the refractory CMV infection. And this is specifically for clinical trials, especially, we had, few drugs under development for either resistant or any CMV infection, that we want to make sure that this trial follow some kind of standardized definitions to make sure that the primary endpoint is a valid one when we look at that. So we defined refractory or resistant refractory CMV infection as CMV viremia that increases by more than one log in blood or serum after 2 weeks of appropriately dosed antiviral therapy. And we went by 2 weeks because I know at the bedside, sometimes we jump the gun rather quickly. We start treatment and we assume it's refractory after 5 days or 3 days. we have to give it the time to see, is it really refractory or not? Antiviral resistant when you have viral genetic mutations as for specific genes that I'm not going to go over, conferring resistance to different antivirals. For CIMV risk factors, prolonged antiviral therapy put them at risk. What about previous antiviral exposure? Suboptimal absorption of the drug if you have oral drug, but immunosuppressive therapy as well. The host also play a big role when we have refractory CIMV infection. Now, we revised the definitions recently. We submitted the manuscript. This is part of the CIMV forum. And what we decided is instead of having two category, probable versus proven refractory CIMV infection, to combine it both, because it makes sense to, you know, and then, you know, what we are proposing is to define refractory infection as increase in one log of CIMV DNA from the peak viral load, of course, or if it persists, less than one log increase or decrease in CIMV DNA level, and of course, after 2 weeks of appropriate antiviral therapy. And for end organ disease, also, we combine it in one category as well. I'm going to go over the first case to bring up a few points with you. So, and this is before the era Maribavir, because that's why we're not going to have Maribavir as a choice in this case. A 57-year-old man with a history of AML underwent match unrelated donor transplant, recipient CIMV seropositive, donor CIMV seronegative, and this is the conditioning regimen. At day plus 30, patient develops CIMV reactivation, 600 IU per ml. We started on oral valganciclovir. That was pretty good. He engrafted pretty well. So oral valganciclovir, 900 POBID, then transitioned to 900 once a day when the viral load became undetectable. Day plus 65, and then valganciclovir was stopped. At day plus 65, patient developed grade 3 skin GVHD and started on methylprednisolone high dose. So what's going to happen? They're going to have CIMV reactivation again at 5,500 IU per ml of valganciclovir. So at that point, we restarted patient on valgan at 900 twice a day, but the CIMV viral load continued to rise after 2 weeks, 38,000 IU per ml. We suspected resistance, refractory CIMV infection. We sent a genotype for testing, and we switched him to foscarnet. Renally adjusted, viral load went down after 10 days. But he had worsening kidney dysfunction, creatinine of 3.2, and also nausea, some kind of side effect that we tend to forget from foscarnet, which can cause nausea. It's not common, but it can happen in our patient population. At that point, we switched the patient to valganciclovir, renally adjusted, 450 twice a day, and viral load remained around 1,200 for 2 weeks. After 5 to 6 days, we got the genotype assay back, and UL97 mutation was detected, and it was C592G. Keep this in mind. I will go back to that. And no other resistance on UL54 identified, only UL97 mutations. So the first questions, what were the choices in the earlier era of this AML patient with refractory CIMV, ganciclovir resistance and worsening renal function? What would you have done, you know, without the option of maribavir? So would you increase valganciclovir dose? Would you use foscarnet monotherapy? And keep in mind the valgan dose adjusted to renal failure. What about IV letermovir, IV cidofovir, or call ID? I'm not sure what to do. At this point, you know, I think oral valgan is not the option with severe nausea. Foscarnet, 3.2. We had a few cases in the past where patients end up on dialysis. Actually, we had to push for foscarnet. IV letermovir, by itself, we discourage. Don't use it for treatment, especially high viral load or especially end organ disease, not indicated. IV cidofovir, bad experience with it. I don't think it's a good drug for CIMV viremia. Call ID. What would they have done? What we did, actually, based on this specific mutation, which conferred low-level resistance to ganciclovir, we increased the dose of ganciclovir, and we use IV ganciclovir instead of oral valgan, but viral load lingered around 950 IU per ml. Patient has severe neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, despite all the supportive measures, and end up dying with septic shock. did not die from CMV and organ disease, but had multiple organ failure and septic shock from E. coli. So this kind of case, we used to see them in the past, and we used to be consulted quite often, you know, for this kind of difficult cases with all the side effect and all the problem with CMV and the toxicity from all the drugs that we used to use. Now, so how we treat gencitabine-resistant CMV? Either you increase the dose of ganciclovir, foscarnet, or maribavir are two options for us. If you don't have renal failure, you can go with foscarnet, maribavir, another option for this kind of infection. Letermovir, I would say no. I discourage using letermovir, especially by itself, to treat this kind of infection. And as I mentioned, cidofovir, lots of side effect and probably does not work. Now, we know why it's important to talk about resistant refractory, because we know the outcome from this infection is pretty bad. As you see in one of the studies from Robin Avery's, they're looking at SOT and HCT, where the percentage of tissue-invasive CMV infection was pretty high, virological failure while on foscarnet was pretty high, and mortality within 1 year, especially in stem cell transplant recipients, around 59%. So bad outcome. We know that. We don't want to get to the stage where we have to treat refractory and or resistant CMV infections. Now, this is a study from our centers also where we looked at comparing resistant versus refractory versus clinical response, initial clinical response. We found the same thing. High incidence of CMV and organ disease, CMV-associated mortality and overall mortality was pretty high. And this, you see it in the Kaplan-Meier curve. Incidence of resistant and refractory CMV infection and organ disease was much higher than if someone responded quickly to antiviral therapy. And if you look at mortality or cause mortality, refractory CMV infection had the highest mortality. It's interesting. So it's not only the virus, the host can dictate outcome at the same time. That's why you have refractory with no mutations as well. So unmet need with older antiviral therapy, we know we needed a new drug, safer drug, and effective drug to address all the issue with CMV or even other strategy. So I will stop here and we'll give the mic to Dr. Papanikolaou, who's going to update us on the management.
So we have now three different mechanisms of antivirals. We have on your left the ones that we have grown up with and we love, ganciclovir, foscarnet, and cidofovir. And all of this, all of them cause stopping the CMV replication, DNA replication. The final target is DNA polymerase. Then we have letermovir, which actually is a terminase inhibitor complex. It inhibits the cleavage of these long strands of DNA to the appropriate size to be packaged, and letermovir is only approved for prophylaxis. And on the top right, you will see the PUL97, which is in purple, and you can see that maribavir inhibits this gene, which is responsible for, is very vital for the CMV virus, as we can see on the next slide. So I want to say that for many years, we had only drugs that act on the DNA polymerase, but more recently, we have letermovir, which has a totally separate mechanism of action, and therefore, there is no cross-resistance with the other antivirals. And maribavir that acts in PUL97, incidentally, PL97 is important for the phosphorylation of ganciclovir. And so, as we can see, there could be some potential for cross-resistance with maribavir. And on the very top left, you will see brincidofovir. As Roy mentioned, cidofovir is not a good drug, not because it doesn't have a good antiviral activity, but because of its formulation. Immediately, it goes to the kidneys, is toxic to the kidneys, and is secreted, resulting in low concentration where the drug needs to be. Now, brincidofovir, a lipid ester, bypassed this problem, but the oral form was toxic. It had GI toxicity and is no longer developed. But the IV formulation is quite promising. I think in this meeting, you will see a poster about brincidofovir for the treatment of adenovirus infection. and it doesn't have the GI toxicity in the intravenous formulation. Now, going to maribavir, maribavir, as we said, inhibits the UL97 kinase. And this gene is responsible for viral maturation, is for the packaging of the virions into the nucleocapsid, and also important for the exit of the virions from the nucleus into the cytoplasm. So it has a multimodal mechanism of action, is orally bioavailable, and is CMV-specific. It doesn't affect other herpes viruses. There is some activity against EBV, but for now we don't know what that means. Maribavir was initially studied for prophylaxis at a lower dose, but that trial failed. Subsequently, it was studied in a dose-ascending dose for resistant refractory CMV. And as you can see, there were three doses that were studied. And with pretty encouraging results across the doses, about two-thirds of the patients responded, meaning they had clearance of CMV viremia at 6 weeks, which is a pretty good result for refractory infections. As you can see, there is not a dose response effect. All doses performed about the same, and this is also an unexplained issue with maribavir. In any case, the lowest dose, 400 milligrams BID, was chosen for a phase 3 trial. This is still from the phase 2 trial that showed that most of the recurrences with maribavir occurred during treatment. But I want to caution you that in that phase 2 study, the treatment could be continued up to 24 weeks on the discretion of the investigator. And very few recurrences happened off study. Moving to the phase 3 study, its name is Solstice. It was a very large study where patients were randomized to receive maribavir or the investigator's choice. And the investigator's choice could be ganciclovir or foscarnet, or even a combination of the two, or cidofovir. And the trial was open label, of course, due to the design. The primary endpoint was confirmed viremia clearance at the end of 8 weeks of treatment. And the secondary endpoints was clearance of viremia at 8 weeks and persistence control of the viremia and the signs and symptoms for the duration of the study. It included, notably, it included not only stem cell transplant, but also solid organ transplants. And here is the primary endpoint. On the left, you can see that about 55% of patients on maribavir cleared viremia compared to 24% of patients on the investigator's choice. And looking to your right, you will see at each time point that it was looked at week 12, at week 16, that was the secondary endpoint, and at week 20. At any time point, maribavir had an advantage over the investigator's choice. So clearly, that was a good drug for resistant and refractory CMV and led to the FDA approval for this indication. Now we looked at different subgroups, and maribavir performed equally well in all the subgroups. And I think the only thing I wanted to point out is that in the presence of resistance mutations, the maribavir therapy was favored, which of course makes sense because maribavir addressed the underlying problem of the resistance mutations. Now, some other interesting endpoints of the Solstice studies, it decreased hospitalizations and the length of stay. And I think a lot of this has to do with many times hospitalization in the old days was required for patients receiving foscarnet. And so by eliminated the need for foscarnet, this by itself reduce hospitalization, but there could be other reasons, including workup for CMV disease or treatment-related toxicities that required hospitalization from the investigator's choice. Now, has any of you come to the point that you're stuck between a rock and a hard place when you need to treat somebody with CMV that has bad counts and is kind of elderly and has underlying renal toxicity from prior medication, calcineurin inhibitors? Any of you? Let's see. Okay. All right. So, of course, we know that ganciclovir treatment is associated with neutropenia, and neutropenia is not only just a laboratory results, but it has tangible bad consequences. It's been associated with more bacterial infections and fungal infections. And in the old days, this is from 2009, it was associated with decreased overall survival and event-free survival. I have to say that these days, because we are so heavy on prophylaxis, we may mitigate some of the unwanted effects of neutropenia, because most of our patients are on mold-active azole prophylaxis, and in many centers they are also on antibacterial prophylaxis. But neutropenia really has a cost. It also obligates us to use alternative treatment for pneumocystis, which is not optimal, and also adjust immunosuppression. So it's not a good thing. Definitely for SCARNET, there's no reason to talk about this. It's associated with nephrotoxicity, which also is associated with decreased survival in the long end. Now, maribavir in the Solstice study was very safe. I think the signature side effect of maribavir is dysgeusia, which is altered taste or bad taste. However, that was not a prominent reason for discontinuation. But I want to just point you to the last two rows. When we looked at neutropenia in patients that were assigned to ganciclovir, you see about 35% of patients developed neutropenia compared to 10% of patients on maribavir. And with foscarnet, 21% of patients had acute kidney injury compared to 8% on maribavir. So clearly, there was no signal for nephrotoxicity or neutropenia. Where are we going next? So the Aurora study was planned to address what I asked you earlier, namely, what do you do if you need to treat somebody for first CMV viremia, but they cannot really tolerate very well ganciclovir or foscarnet? And this was a randomized controlled study. A large one, 547 patients, they were randomly assigned to maribavir versus valganciclovir for treatment of first CMV viremia, asymptomatic. The primary endpoint was clearance of viremia at week 8, and you can see the results. 69% of patients on maribavir cleared compared to 77% on valganciclovir. The trial did not meet the primary endpoint of non-inferiority to valganciclovir with a pre-specified non-inferiority margin of 7%. However, meaningful results, and you can see now not only on week 8, but in subsequent time points, the initial difference in favor of valganciclovir kind of disappeared, and by week 12, 15, 16 and 20, there was no difference in people that continue to have sustained viremia clearance. Now, the study confirmed the safety of maribavir. There was no signal for neutropenia and no signal for nephrotoxicity, and the rate of premature discontinuation was lower for maribavir than valganciclovir. So takeaway messages. Both studies of maribavir confirmed the virologic activity of maribavir and the safety for treatment of CMV, including refractory and resistant CMV, and this was safer compared to conventional agents. The safety and efficacy of maribavir enables clinicians to use it in patients at risk of or experiencing intolerances or toxicities, and those that fail to achieve decline in viral load after 2 weeks of treatment with conventional antivirals. And of course, well-designed real-world studies are needed to optimize outcomes with the expanded anti-CMV armamentarium. Great. Okay, I'll turn it to Roy now.
All right. Excellent. So now we're going to move the last part of our presentation. I'm going to go over one case and bring up a few points and also would like your interaction with this case. This is a patient, a 34-year-old man with also AML who underwent a cord blood transplant, CMV serostatus, D plus, R plus, and conditioning was fludarabine, chlorpheniramine, busulfan ATG, and TBI. We initiated patient on oral letermovir at D plus 5 as per our institutional guideline. That's what we do for all recipient positive. CMV is recipient positive at our institution. His post-transplant course was complicated by early HHV-6 and anemia during the first month of transplant, and he was started or treated with foscarnet at that point. He had also skin GVHD requiring high-dose steroid, and later on he developed CMV viremia that we treated initially with ganciclovir. Okay. After stopping letermovir. Yeah, I think you can see well here. So patient initially, when we started letermovir, he had very low viral load. He did pretty well for many days. And then around day 50, as you see here, 55, his viral load shot up to 11,200. We stopped letermovir. We started patient on IV ganciclovir, 5 mg/kg twice a day, as you see here. But also we submitted the genotypic assay, blood for genotypic assay, looking for UL54 and UL97 resistant, as well as UL56. Anytime we have a kind of breakthrough on letermovir, we sent for genotypic analysis, and both were negative for any mutations. So patient received IV ganciclovir. He had initial response first, and then his viral load went up to 17,800. My first question to you, this is a patient with AML who got letermovir prophylaxis, but had CMV viremia, treated with ganciclovir, but despite with ganciclovir, his viral load went up to 17,500. What would you do next? Increase the doses of IV ganciclovir, add letermovir, or start maribavir or foscarnet and submit for genotypic assay, observe and repeat another CMV viral load in 1 week, or I'm not sure. So what did we do? Because of the little bit high viral load, we decided to use combination therapy, few days of foscarnet with maribavir, and then we stop the foscarnet and we continue maribavir for many, many days, for more than 40 to 50 days. As you see here, got a great response. Initial response went down. This viral load to almost undetectable. But at one point, as you see here, his viral load start to increase again. And now, when he came to us, it was 120,000 IU per ml. So the next question for you, this is the AML patient with refractory CMV. He respond well to maribavir between day 70 to 120, but then experiences viral rebound. What would you do next? Switch to ganciclovir, send a genotype assay for UL56. What about UL97, UL54 assay or genotypic assay? Switch to foscarnet or add letermovir, as no resistance has been documented so far. Keep in mind this patient failed ganciclovir, right? So what we did actually, we switched patient to foscarnet. Interestingly, because we were worried about this very high viral load, we added leflunomide for more than a week, although we stopped it. We used to use leflunomide as adjunct therapy with any antiviral long time ago. Actually, and we published like small case series on it. Not anymore. It was surprising here. We were worried about the patient that we had to use, but we stopped it because he responded very well to foscarnet. But what happened is we submitted the genotypic assay, and what we identified on UL97 is mutation C4ATF. What does it mean? This mutation actually confers resistance to maribavir, but also to ganciclovir. So keep this in mind. There is few mutations where there's cross-resistance between ganciclovir and maribavir that we know of. I'm sure there are going to be more in the future. And we think that patient who had been exposed to ganciclovir maybe was harboring, or, you know, he had low, he had some kind of pre-mutation, I would say, or maybe few percentage of CNV with this mutation, and then we selected for it after we used maribavir as well. It was not detected before. So that's why this cross-resistance with maribavir is going to fail therapy. And we know sometimes you can get a rebound viral load while on maribavir, and it could be related to resistance. That's why we check for mutation on UL97. And this kind of mutation, that's why this cross-resistant with ganciclovir, you have to be cognizant of. But at the same time, we know that we don't use combination ganciclovir with maribavir. And this has to do with the mechanism of action. When ganciclovir needs UL97 to be phosphorylated in order to act on the DNA polymerase, maribavir inhibits UL97. So you're going to have antagonistic action. We don't use them together in any condition. So something to keep in mind as well, based on the mechanism of action of both maribavir and ganciclovir, as you see here. So patient responded very well to foscarin. He did pretty well. I'm going to move quickly. I think, yeah, we still have some time. I will encourage you to read the newly published guidelines. It's been probably now 1 year or two about resistant refractory CINV infection in format of frequently asked questions. But at the time when we published these guidelines, maribavir was not approved at that time. It was still under investigation clinical trial. We mentioned it in the guideline that it could be an option, but we could not make any recommendation. So now the question is, when we are going to update the guidelines, when it comes time to update the guidelines, would maribavir be included as one of the options to treat resistant and refractory CMV infection? So at least we have more option now and safe and effective option to treat this kind of infection. But as we know, these patients are very sick and pretty, you know, difficult to treat and to manage this kind of infection. So maribavir would be probably added if you have ganciclovir resistant, but not the mutation that we worry about. It can confer cross resistance to maribavir. And also, if you have foscarnet or UL54 mutation, this is not going to affect maribavir. There's no cross resistance with UL54 mutations. And also, no cross resistance with etrumovir, totally different mechanism of action. So, in conclusions, resistant refractory CMV infections are associated with high incidence of CMV disease and high all-cause mortality. So something to keep in mind. We don't want to get to a stage when you have refractory or resistant CMV infection, because we know the host not doing well and treating this infection gonna be pretty hard and difficult at the time. But we know that maribavir, at least now based on the clinical trial on real-world experience, it is kind of a new option, kind of game changer, where we have other option where you can use it to treat this kind of infection when you have resistant refractory CMV infection. So I think this is my last slide, and we're going to have a good time for questions and answers. I'm going to start with the first one. I have to do with risk factor, and then you can take the next one. Is it feasible? Actually, it's about mutation. Is it feasible to test for resistant mutations before starting any additional antiviral therapy for treatment of refractory CMV infection when treatment of refractory CMV is present? So the question is: let us say a patient been exposed to ganciclovir, and you want to start foscarnet or maribavir. Do we need to test for resistant to foscarnet or maribavir? I don't think it is indicated. Having de novo mutations pretty rare for any of these drugs, including maribavir. We looked at it in the phase 3 trial. We didn't find much of de novo mutation before exposure to the drug. Now, the only thing that I will probably recommend, if you have been long-term exposure to ganciclovir, I may check your N97 looking for the specific mutation for maribavir. Want to take the next question?
Okay. So a couple of interesting ones. So can maribavir be used for refractory CMV viremia in a four-month-old after six out of six cord blood transplant for SCID, not responding to IV ganciclovir for SCARNET, and CMV CTLs? So this is a very tough one. So whoever is in the audience that can answer this question, please come up. I will say that maribavir cannot use that present because we do not have a dose available, so we would not know how to dose it. I think a smaller issue that could be resolved is that maribavir is only available orally, but I assume that the four-month-old could have an NG tube. But I think the biggest problem that we cannot use it is that there is no dose available for a four-year-old. And this is a very tough situation. I hear some details. I would say that if you have access to a different CMV CTL line, you could use that. I don't know, Roy, if he has suggestions.
Yeah, no, for kids, I'm not sure about the dosage. Now, there's no data, it's not indicated, only 12 and up. And I don't remember there's any ongoing trial in pediatric, which I don't think so. I didn't hear about that. I don't know if anyone in the audience heard about that. But I would caution you, we don't know really. There's no data in this and in pediatric patients.
Yeah.
Okay. The next question, I'm going to take it. Are there risk factors? For resistant refractory CMV that are challenging to capture or easy to miss? Interesting question, I would say, because we look at the regular offenders, right? We look at antiviral exposures, malabsorptions, or interruption of therapy even. But I think the hosts play a role, especially in refractory CMV, right? When you have refractory infection, what does it mean? You test for mutation, you don't find them on genotypic analysis. So I think it has to do more with the host. My theory is also that we need more data. When T cell, CMV specific T cell play probably a major role in addition to treatment to control CMV infection. So it's not only the antiviral. I think the combination of both have a role. So maybe. Now, the risk factor, do they have any CMV T cell responses or not that can explain the refractory stage of their CMV infection or maybe something else? I don't know if any have other, risk factors. So, but this is a good question. I'm sure there's unhidden risk factor that we cannot really detect or we don't think about that could go this kind of refractory infection. Yes, is someone standing in the back with a live question? I can't see well. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi, this is Michael Burke from Seattle. I just wanted to comment on this pediatric question because this actually does come up, and I'm speaking here as a physician and not on behalf of anybody because this is unapproved stuff. But I just want to remind people that that the drug maribavir has actually been studied at way higher doses than we currently use in the earlier studies, and safety was never was not the issue. So, in a 4 year old, maybe 40 pounds, I would guess, given the PK and by extrapolation, I think there's a dose that one can come up with, and you can talk to me after the meeting. Maybe 100 to 200 BID, something like that. But that's not FDA approved.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I think that, in desperate circumstances, you can a lot of things. And providing the kid can absorb, right, it could be, would be dissolving the capsule, the tablet. Okay. So there are a couple of questions here. Would you ever increase antiviral doses to overcome persistent but not necessarily increased viral load? Do you want to?
So the case about the dosage, if we increase the dose of maribavir, probably the question?
No, I think it was the dose of any antiviral. I think that this is a little bit problematic. Obviously, for Foscarnet, there is limiting toxicity. For ganciclovir, increased dose is used to overcome low-level resistance, but I'm not sure that if the patient has persistent but not necessarily rising viral load, that I would increase, but I leave it.
Yeah, right. So for the regular antivirals we're using for decades, yeah, I think what Zenia mentioned, increase the dose is going to cause more and more serious toxicities and side effects. Now, I know a few cases, not in my center, in different centers, where they had to use, they increase the dose or double the dose of maribavir based on what Dr. Wok was saying. We have data about safety, although the efficacy was the same when you go to 800 twice a day versus 1200. It could, some people may end up using when you are, when you have very challenging case and they're not responding, probably in combination with other drug as well, it could be the case. But for the other drugs, especially even if you have low-level resistance to ganciclovir, as you saw in the previous case, increasing the dose or doubling the dose or even a little bit less than doubling the dose gonna create, gonna cause serious side effects. And we have another one also, another question from...
Yeah. My name is Marjorie from UC Camargo, Brazil. And my question is for both of you. If the patient is on maribavir and if he clear before 8 weeks of treatment, do you decide to stop the maribavir before 8 week?
Yes. Yeah. So clinical trials, as you know, it has to be 8 weeks. But if, and we do it all the time, if patient responded and you have undetectable viral load, I would stop the treatment. But keep in mind, as we know, these patients are at risk not only for one episode of CMV, but for recurrent and multiple recurrent, unless you put them back on some kind of prophylaxis. Secondary prophylaxis, sometimes we use letermovir, sometimes we don't. Because if you stop it, the patient may reactivate again and could be also not a clear outcome or good outcome after that. Zenia, do you want to?
I agree with that.
Okay.
We have a few questions about letermovir. The one question is, have you moved to use letermovir as prophylaxis in all patients, either donor or recipient, or both positive, or still using it only in seropositive recipients? So we do use it only in seropositive recipients as per the original FDA approval. We don't use it in any other setting. Do we recommend letermovir PO prophylaxis post 100 days? Yes. At Sloan Kettering, we have been using letermovir extended duration prophylaxis even before the study, the extended duration study. The extended duration study is now published at Lancet Hematology. We use it in our high-risk patients, so anybody with HLM mismatch, tableau identicals, cords, or any form of T-cell depletion, including post-Psy. And I don't know, you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, so So what we do in our situation, we use all recipient positive, regardless if they are high risk, low risk, we use it up to day 100. But some patients, as Zenia mentioned, we may extend it further. Another question, same as the Marjorie's question about stopping ganciclovir, after having negative PCR or even the maintenance to avoid toxicity or resistance. As I mentioned earlier, these patients are going to be, if they continue to be at risk for CMV, as soon as you're going to stop the drug, they may recur. That's why, at least now these days, we have a safe drug, even though it's not indicated for secondary prophylaxis, but there's good data published from different, centers, including from France, about secondary prophylaxis with letermovir. So if you have an access or you have an option to put patient on prophylaxis, of course, stop the drug, put them on prophylaxis. Now, for how long? This is the question. If there's still the risk factor still ongoing, let us say high-dose steroid, GVHD, or many other complications, I would continue as long as it takes the secondary prophylaxis.
Yeah, and I think this is the same question. Is it feasible to switch to letermovir if Locium-V titer is achieved after treatment with ganciclovir? And I would say yes. We recently have completed the trial of secondary prophylaxis. Letermovir secondary prophylaxis works very well when you start it with viral load that is preferably undetectable or very, very low. I think there is also another publication that showed a high level of failure with letermovir when it was used for treatment with high viral load, but patients who started with viral load less than 1,000, only 2 of 10 patients developed recurrent viremia or letermovir failed. So if you're going to use letermovir as a secondary prophylaxis, my recommendation is to use it when the viral load is controlled.
Yeah, on the low side, yeah, absolutely. Another question about the viral load. So if the viral load continues to increase while the patient is on induction therapy within the first 2 weeks, do you consider this lack of response or do you wait for the full 2 weeks? Do you take into consideration the log increase? So this is the reason. So what we published earlier about the definitions of refractory, it meant for clinical trial use to make sure we have standardized definition and standardized approach when you're enrolling the patient with refractory CMV infection. That's why we talked about, one log increase or even persistent. Doesn't have to be one log increase, but persistent of CMV viral load or less than a log decrease or less than a log increase even is considered refractory. Now, clinically, we would like to wait at least 10 to 14 days because we know this antiviral, especially against ganciclovir, take time to start, show the efficacy. And sometimes you have a blip as soon as you start ganciclovir. After a few days, the viral load will increase. So that's why we want to give it enough time before we jump the gun and start switching to another drug, could be toxic drugs as well. So I know we are sometimes impatient itchy to switch drug. But I would caution you because New York are exposing patient to maybe foscarnet, it's going to be pretty toxic drug when it could not be needed. So I would wait usually 7 to 10 days, 14 days, especially if the viral load is not jumping up quickly, especially when we don't have evidence of end organ disease. So if you have end organ disease, different story. Then you can do the switch. But also, especially if they're progressing and not improving. But for viral load, don't switch when you have maybe a little bit of variation in viral load. Sometimes you start with 1,000, and then after 4 or 5 days, now it is 1,200 or 1,500. This is not a big jump. This is not something to worry about. I would continue. I would stay the course. Thank you all for your attention, and thank you for staying for this info as well.
This activity is certified by the Medical College of Wisconsin for Physicians and by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education for Nurses. This activity was developed in collaboration with our educational partner, PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/WAV860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals USA, Incorporated.